gather round, it's time for the big pen hold down. Kick up your heels, jump up and down, shut your eyes and whirl around. Reach out your hand and if no one's there, grab your own hand, dance round in a square.
When you're doing the big pen hold down, gotta have a collar you can trust, cause when big pen does a hold down, he really kicks up some dust.
Boy.
Move. All right, Pig Pen time, ladies and gentlemen. Here he is, your host, Danny.
Sponsorless.
You know, for now.
July 25th, this coming Saturday, marks an anniversary, a very special anniversary to me, and maybe to you too. I don't know. I don't know how this piece of art affected your lives as young men, boys, if you will. But 40 years ago, this coming Saturday, was the 7th studio release, a recording album, long playing vinyl record from the great band, the Australian band AC/DC, titled Back in Black. This record changed a lot of things for me. I don't know about you guys.
Were you into them at all? Were you into Dirty Deeds?
Nope. Or
I wasn't either.
This was all a revisionist experience for me. After discovering Back in Black, I don't know, Bob, what your history was when you were, what, maybe 8 or 9?
Yeah, I mean, clearly at the very beginning, being all churched up like I was, they were definitely on our schedule as rival.
Yeah, this was on the Bob Larson taboo list, I'm sure.
Oh, yeah. I came around on AC/DC once I was able to...
Listen to them,
you know, figure things out a little bit, but at first they were thought to be well off limits for for the young church lad.
Well, this record was released, like I said, July 25th in 1980. Now, the previous year, they had achieved finally some breakthrough success, where one of their first album to really chart in the U.S. was called Highway to Hell. And this featured their original lead singer, Bon Scott. And what kind of propelled them, in a lot of people's opinion and estimation, to that type of notoriety, fame, success, commercial success, was the fact that they employed the producer, John Mutt Lange, to do Highway to Hell. It was the first time they'd worked with him. And John Mutt Lange, to people in the know and even on the periphery, he's a pretty huge name as a producer.
He is.
He's kind of like a hit maker. So if you brought in Mutt Lange, you were ready to at least have a real solid chance of a breakout record and having your reach expand exponentially. John Mutt Lange was a producer that created such classics, huge, huge, huge hits for bands that up to that point really were kind of just mid-level, upper mid-level. He produced the Foreigner 4 record.
Oh, wow.
Now, we knew everything about, you know, Double Vision and Hot Blooded and all that stuff, and Foreigner was pretty big, but come on. Foreigner 4 with Jukebox Hero, Urgent.
It was huge.
What was the other huge? I've been Waiting for a Girl Like You.
Yeah.
I mean, that was the soundtrack of, I guess it was 1979,
81.
Foreigner 4 was massive. He also produced Def Leppard's Pyromania.
Wow, I didn't know that.
Yeah, so Photograph, Rock of Ages, Fooling, all of those tracks. That was all John Mutt Lange. And he was kind of thought by a lot of these bands is kind of the extra member, like the sixth or seventh member of these bands, because not only was he a taskmaster in the studio and make you do multiple takes, everything had to be perfect. He also worked on arrangements. He would write lyrics. He would write parts. He was a huge, huge part of the process of songwriting, production, the whole process of making your album big.
So is the whole story of this album, though, aside from the genius producer?
Oh, there's lots more, Bob.
Well, no. The timing, though, is really interesting to me because I didn't know this part.
Yeah.
I didn't know the close proximity of the death and then this album of Bon Scott. That's really interesting. I'm sorry.
Okay, let me continue on. More with Mutt Lange. He produced the Cars' Heartbeat City. Heartbeat City was their breakout huge album that got that huge commercial success. Now, I'm not saying these bands were nobody's before, nobody's prior to his involvement.
He made them explode.
He made them explode, and to that you cannot underestimate what he did for Shania Twain's career. He essentially made her and then had her.
Right.
So those are just four massive, massive albums. Shania Twain's The Woman and Me. So his involvement, it started with Highway to Hell. And a very unfortunate situation happened because early in 1980, I believe in February, their lead singer, Bon Scott, passed away February 19th of 1980 after partying, doing some drugs. He was found passed out in the back of a car. They rushed him to the hospital. He was pronounced dead at the scene. I believe the initial cause of death was he choked to death on his own vomit, but the official coroner's report said it was alcohol poisoning. But it was it was asphyxiation due to him.
First time I'd ever heard that.
Drowning in his own puke.
Yeah.
Was the band together at the time, or was he taking time off and doing their thing?
They weren't doing anything at the time, I don't believe.
Not really. But if they weren't doing anything at the time, I'll be damned if they did not waste any time getting back on the horse.
Yeah.
So think about how long right now it takes a band to put something together. Say they come out with a release. It's at minimum a year.
Absolutely.
Before a follow-up. Yeah, okay.
That's what I didn't grasp.
Not only did they not waste any time mourning the death of their lead singer and identity of their band, their group, which had been together. I mean, arguably Angus Young is a huge part of the identity of that band, and he's the mascot of the band. This band had been together for 7 years, had recorded seven albums. God. They were ready to blow up with their next album. Their lead singer dies in March 29th of that same year, just 10 days and a month past Bon Scott passing away. Brian Johnson, after going through two auditions, is offered the lead singer job. In 5 weeks, they have their new lead singer, and 1 month later, they go to the Bahamas after 1 week of rehearsal with Brian Johnson and record their new album in 1 month.
Which, by the way, Angus and Malcolm Young, they wrote that before Brian Johnson auditioned. They wrote
the entire album basically in a few weeks.
They wrote all day, all night, through the weekends, writing, and then they thought, okay, now let's find a singer.
Now, you've got to think that Angus, or Malcolm, he was basically the chief writer of the music in that band, he had these riffs laying around.
He had
to have these riffs just sitting around, but they probably got together and started, okay, we need to write this album. And they did, and they wrote it in a very short amount of time, hired a new singer, had a week of rehearsals, flew to the Bahamas and recorded the damn thing in 5 weeks, and it was released 2 months later, mixed, mastered, and worldwide release in July 25th, 1980.
God,
that's insane.
It is insane, and look, you're not talking about doing digital recordings with Pro Tools where you can email mixes back and forth to one another and, oh, well, I don't know, I don't like this part, I need to fix my guitar part on this and all that crap. No, you were in it together, you're recording the tape, you're working with a taskmaster who is making you do repeated takes. The amount of hours that had to have been put in that short amount of time, I don't know when these guys slept to get those 10 songs
they may
released.
Not have.
I wonder what the hurry was. Like, they were acting like they're in the Amazing Race.
Dude, it was the way it was done back then.
It was.
Really?
It truly was the way things were done back then.
And I've told this story before, but I saw an interview with Bono and Mick Jagger, and Bono was asking Mick about how did you write, record, release all these albums in a 6 year span? Seven albums.
Mm-hmm.
U2 releases one every 6 years.
Yeah.
And he was mixed like, it's just the way you did it.
My
it's
God.
Just the way it was.
To the first half or 65, 70% of the Beatles' career, they were releasing albums twice a year.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, I guess. And while that is absolutely spot on, I wondered, was Brian Johnson a friend? Or did they literally find him in a stack of auditions and hired him and put him on like their biggest album? Right. I mean, it's so fast.
Yeah, he was a singer in another band. I believe Brian, the rest of the band is Australian. Brian is from Wales, if I'm not mistaken, but some part of the UK. And he was in a band. I think the name of his band was Georgie, which is kind of funny.
Yeah.
And I guess they had heard of him or whatever, but yeah, they brought him in and they loved him.
Is it Jordy?
Jordy or something like that.
I think it's Jordy because he's a Newcastle guy, and they're the Jordies, I think.
Maybe that's what it is.
I think it's a soccer thing, believe it or not.
So when this record came out, this and like most music I was introduced to, especially rock and roll, it came from my best friend's older sister, who was about 6 years our senior. And this was, it permeated throughout his home. When I went over to hang out with my buddy, you heard this album. We were like, what is that? And of course, you pick up the record. It's all black. It's got AC/DC back in black and that cool logo that they have with block letters with a nice gray or silvery kind of silhouette. And it just looked evil. It looked mysterious. It looked like something you weren't supposed to listen to.
Yeah, that's true.
And then you saw the list of the songs. Now, think about this. We know the hits. We know Back in Black, and we know You Shook Me All Night Long. No, everybody in the world knows those songs. Yeah. But when you put this thing on side one and drop the needle, this is what you heard.
It's so haunting.
You had to wait until track five. You had to wait until you flip the album over to side B to hear Back in Black and You Shook Me All Night Long back to back. This is, of course, Hell's Bells, the lead turd off of AC/DC's Back in Black. A fun fact, they searched all over the Bahamas to find a bell. They even went to a church to record a bell remotely and could not get the right sound. They finally ended up finding the right bell that was in perfect tune with the track and recorded the bell at Ronnie Lane's studio. And it was pretty much the last thing they added to this record. And then pretty much when this was done, they mixed it and got it mastered and started production, the manufacturing of the LPs, and started shipping them out. I cannot believe their singer died in February. They got a new singer, wrote an album, recorded it, mastered it, and it was in worldwide release at the end of July.
It makes no sense.
The son of a bitch went on to sell 50 million copies worldwide.
Hey, Danny, I have a question for you that you are uniquely prepared to answer. Did AC/DC have a problem with Metallica basically using what sounds like the exact same bell for Whom the Bell Tolls? Like, the start sounds identical, doesn't it?
It does.
Like 3 years later, right?
I think they probably thought it was a nice nod to them.
Or did they? Know? Yeah. Or did they feel like we're all friends? I have no idea.
Listen to the voice too. Crank it up. Because this is the first introduction.
Yeah, this is it.
And people are waiting. Like,
what's the new guy going to sound like?
You'd read stories and heard things like, oh my God, this guy's badass.
Yeah, this guy could scream his lungs out.
That's such an insane voice.
That's so cool.
And you listen to this record. You put this thing on your headphones, and it is drums. It's Phil Rudd's drums. It's Cliff Williams' bass playing. It's Malcolm on one channel with rhythm guitar. It's Angus on the other side mimicking him until he takes the lead. And it is Brian and Malcolm and Cliff singing background vocals. And that's it. There's no overdubs. There's no keyboards. There's no extra guitar parts. It is what it is. And it's just the best way I can describe this record is just muscular.
Yeah. You know, my favorite song on the whole record is Shoot to Thrill.
That's a lot of people's favorite song,
I think that beginning of that song still, like, I mean, it makes you want to go just punch a wall, you know?
Kick that one off, Mino. This is for you, Corby.
Yeah.
You can have some too, Bob.
Always.
These are all such hockey warm-up songs.
Yeah. I've always thought, though, this was the best song on the record.
And you think about, not only were these songs massive radio hits that are still getting airplay today, this is arena rock, man. These are in every damn arena all the time. And they're getting cash every time they're played.
Yeah.
These guys are rich beyond their wildest dreams on one record.
Yeah.
I mean, truly, one record.
So, is this still known as one of the best three or four heavy metal records ever made?
I think it's the best. I can't think of a better one when you think about the history of heavy metal. And I'm talking Judas Priest, Metallica. It's the best one. And the fact that this was able, in a time of when the world of music, the landscape of music was changing to new wave and synth, punk was kind of dying at this point, These were kind of dinosaurs, even though they were probably not even 30 yet.
Right.
These were dinosaur rockers. For them to have the mass commercial success that they did, playing Shoot the Thrill and Hell's Bells and Let Me Put My Love Into You and Giving the Dog a Bone. I mean,
yeah.
Come on.
Yeah. Another question on that front, though. Did they want the second guy to sound a little like Bon Scott?
No. No, not really. They didn't. They wanted him to be different enough so they weren't hiring a mimic. Because he sounds nothing like Bond.
Right.
Yeah.
Nothing at all.
And I just wondered, did that just happen?
A lot of critics...
But you couldn't go for, like, Morrissey. I mean, you had to have something that was relatable to what you'd listened to for 7 or 8 years.
And much like Van Halen, arguably, the people... I mean, this is one of those rare occasions where you change lead singers midstream in your career and become exponentially more successful than you were with the guy you had before, who was very well thought of.
Yeah.
I mean, people weren't hating on David Lee Roth other than just David Lee Roth haters. But when Sammy Hagar came along, you can't argue that their commercial success quadrupled.
No, he had to teach him a few things.
But, I mean, this album is seminal. It is in my lifetime.
50 million?
50 million worldwide up to this point.
Half in the U.S. or so?
Yeah, about 20, 25 in the U.S.
Isn't that something?
That's crazy. You just don't see that anymore.
No, you absolutely don't. Did you guys, again, you guys know way more about a lot of this music stuff than I could ever dream of. As I'm looking at their Wikipedia page of AC/DC, I'm just thrown off. So Axl Rose is in AC/DC now?
What?
I think he was doing some weird tour
with them.
It says,
members of AC/DC, they have all the past ones, of course, those who have left us. And then they have Angus Young, Chris Slade, Stevie Young, and Axl Rose as the four members of AC/DC right now.
I'm not familiar with that.
But these riffs are just sick.
Yeah.
When this gets going, come on.
Critics hated it.
They didn't
too.
Like it. But you know what?
It's critics.
Critics don't like a lot of stuff.
No. Nope.
But, oh my God. I mean, there's just such a beautiful, powerful simplicity to what they do. And look, they've just kind of been mimics of themselves since basically this record. And for those about to rock, they haven't really made that.
Yeah.
That record
what
that just
that?
Has pretty much the next year. I mean, these guys were prolific when it came to releasing albums.
They wanted to play a show, too, with Brian that nobody knew about because he was so nervous.
The one in Belgium?
Yeah. In front of 2,000 people, unannounced, fake name, type thing. They show up and they say that they knew within 3 songs. Like, people were going so berserker.
Yeah, it was kind of like their test audience.
Yeah.
And the good thing, I mean, when you lose a singer, kind of a big deal, and everybody wants to hate on the new guy, their fans were so loyal that when they toured with Brian initially, there were people in the audience with signs going, "Good luck, Brian. We love you. We miss you, Bond, but Brian, it's yours now." It was
really
a cool kind of familial experience of people like really banding together around the group and supporting them as they went forth.
I didn't know nothing about any of this type of music at the time as a 10 or 11 year old kid, but this certainly was the first one of that ilk that grabbed me and was like, whoa.
It's powerful.
I mean, this is it.
It makes you feel like you're doing something naughty.
Right.
You feel rebellious when you listen to this, when all you've grown up listening to is I don't know, what's her name? Anne Murray.
Right.
Is it okay?
Or the Bee Gees.
Is it okay to consider Thunderstruck in my top 5 AC/DC
You can do whatever
tunes?
You want,
I'm
man.
I'm just curious. Are you looking down on me right now?
That guy
bit,
on the,
that's
the,
me.
The Mavs Thunderstruck guy kind of beat that one down.
Yeah. No, I know, but
what happened to him?
But
it's not your fault.
That is an awesome song if you don't think about the Mavs guy lip syncing it.
Anyway, happy birthday, Back in Black. We love you.
Hell's
that's great.
Yeah.